News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is Don Mullally, Director of Broadcasting for WILL. Earlier this month, a key subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives voted to cut federal funding for public broadcasting by 45%. These cuts will be devastating for the WILL stations. Some in Congress believe public broadcasting is one of the worthiest places to invest federal funds. We hope you will call your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. But please act soon. The full House of Representatives could take final action on these cuts by Wednesday, June 22nd. For the phone numbers of your members of Congress, visit our website at will.uiuc.edu or call 217-333-1070. It's very important that Washington hear from you on whether federal funding for WILL should be cut or restored. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, it's Computers and You. Today, we welcome back to the program science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. Greg also writes two columns for the newspaper about computing. They run on Mondays in the circuits section of the paper. One is a question and answer column, the other a column featuring interesting websites. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions about computers and computing. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks, Celeste. It's good to be here.
Well, let's, before we get any calls this afternoon, why don't we talk a little bit about Apple and its switch to Intel chips. Is it significant?
Kind of a shocking thing for some people. And yeah, I think it is significant. You know, I don't have a direct pipeline to Steve Jobs or anything, but I recall once reading him saying what Apple wanted was to have options. Now, this is before the Intel thing, and I really think that's kind of what this is all about. You know, they go with Intel. They're the big chip maker, obviously, in the industry. They make everything from, really fast chips for high-end serving computers down to nice low-power chips with built-in wireless for laptops. And they also have a chip which Apple used to use, and it's a Newton device for handheld devices. So they've got all kinds of options now with the chips they get from Intel, and they can pretty much do all kinds of, and I imagine, interesting things. Let's face it, Apple's a niche player in the computer market, but what they're known for is, things like the Mac Mini and the iPod and the various permutations of the iMac with the different look that they have. And going with Intel gives them the stuff under the hood to be able to do that, which they weren't getting with the IBM chip that they were using. Hmm. So that's, from their perspective, from the consumer's perspective, mm-hmm. that's really a big question. What do I do if I mm-hmm. was going to buy a Mac, next week or the week after or later this summer, which, I've been helping a couple of people who were, in fact, going to do that. And what I said to them is, look, buy it anyway. This is not going to happen overnight. It's probably going to be, it's going to be, Apple has stated that it's going to be a couple of years before they even go entirely to Intel chips in their line. And it's probably going to be a good five, and I would say maybe even a little more than that, years before they really make the transition. And in that time, you're going to get software that'll run on both platforms, so you're not really going to notice it. They've created, or they've bought more accurately, a system that will allow older software to run that's been done for the PowerPC to run the chip that they use now to run on those new Intel chips. so that most people, except maybe for a little speed hit, probably won't notice it. And, you know, they did a similar thing way back when they actually changed from the Motorola chip they were using before to the IBM PowerPC chip that they're using now, IBM and Motorola. They had transitory systems like this in place, and you really didn't notice it. Mm-hmm. You put your old software in, you clicked it up, and it ran. And I think that that's kind of what will happen here. Maybe not, you know, as seamlessly, and you always take something of a performance hit on that kind of thing because the software hasn't been optimized for that new chip. But it's more than good enough for most people, and I think generally, if you're a consumer, you're not going to much notice it. Who notices, you know, if you got in your car tomorrow and it had a different engine, but it started up and ran just like, you know, mm-hmm. it always does, and you could go to the gas station and put gas in it just like you always do, you know, you wouldn't really care. And I think that's the same kind of thing that's going to happen here.
Yeah. What does this mean for IBM?
Well, you know, they didn't say, but I imagine IBM is not all that upset about it because Apple was a small part of their business and a big hassle, on top of that, because they had to do a lot of work to get these chips. You know, they want to sell these chips for other things. They want to sell them for, you know, high performance computing. Well, that's not that's not your iMac or your iBook or even your PowerBook, you know. So they were having to invest a lot of time and effort in these chips for not much gain, you know, and then the next thing they have down the road is to sell them for game machines. The next version or the next iteration of the PowerPC chip that they're making called the Cell, that's going to go in the PlayStation 3, you know. So they have other things in mind that are bigger business and more profitable than Apple. So I doubt that they're all that unhappy about it. And I don't think it hurts them business-wise.
Yeah. The folks that you're helping, we're talking with your friends about, you know, getting a new Apple. Are all the Apples that are now out there available, they're on sale, are they all stocked up with Tiger or...
I would imagine at this point, unless you buy it, you know, used or from someone who's selling surplus, and I don't think there's much of that out there. Yeah, they'd all be running what OS 10.4, which is Apple's code name for that is Tiger, or formal name for it now that it's been released.
Yeah,
since they're following this big cat pattern.
Right,
and that's that's another point to be made about the switch to the Intel chip. Tiger, the current iteration of the operating system, runs on those PowerPC chips, so you're good to go there. The next iteration of the operating system, which will probably come out about 18 months from now, I think that's codenamed Leopard, that's going to run both on Intel and PowerPC chips. And it's not a particularly big deal, and in fact, Apple has provided tools for software developers to prepare their software to run on both those. So I don't think you're going to see the PowerPC go away very quickly. It's going to take a number of years for that transition to be made. So, you know, if you bought a Mac now or later in the year, it's not like, you know, in 2 years you're going to have to turn around and buy a new one or you're out of the game.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and it's the third Thursday of the month. And so we're talking about computers this afternoon. Our guest this month, the science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions about computers. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. No one waiting at the moment. I think this is the longest we've gone.
Wow.
You know, at the outset of one of these programs without a telephone call.
Maybe it's those summer doldrums.
Well, I hope not.
I might add, continuing on the Apple Intel vein, that one of the people that was out there for the big presentation was Theo Gray, who's, kind of the super software guy at Wolfram, which makes Mathematica here in town. And just in exchanging email with Theo, he says it's not really even a very big deal for them to redo their software to run on those Intel chips. In fact, I think he said they had to change something like 20 lines of code, and they already had a version of Mathematica, which is a complex program running out there on the Intel box, MacTel box, I guess, that they were displaying at the big announcement. So I think that it's not going to be the painful transition that some people might think it's going to be.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what else should we talk about this afternoon as we wait for folks to give us a call?
Well, we could talk a little bit about podcasting if you'd like
okay.
to do that. I don't know how familiar most people are with that, but it's something that's getting quite a bit of buzz. And essentially what it is people rolling their own radio programs. So they're already rolling their own newspapers
blogging
on the internet, replacing me. And now they're rolling their own radio programs, and they're going to
replace
you.
Me.
Celeste, we're in bad shape. But this is kind of an interesting thing because, again, it's kind of, in a sense, you mentioned blogging, and it is like weblogging. You know, there are weblogs and there are weblogs. Some of it is just people putting their thoughts down, and you might wonder about the value of that, and it might be valuable to you, it might not. Some of it is people that have a real passion for things. And, they write about those things, and a lot of the information they provide is good and useful and interesting information. I think podcasts, which are essentially radio broadcasts that people sit down and record at their computer and then make available on the web, usually almost entirely in MP3 format, so they can be played in any, portable digital music player you might think of. You get a piece of software. The easy way to do it is to get a piece of software called an aggregator that allows you to, in essence, subscribe to these radio programs that are at various sites. And then occasionally that software goes out and it checks to see if there's a new program. And if it is, it brings it into your computer, and then your computer shifts it into your digital music player, or you can listen to it right on the computer. And just in exploring some of these things, again, some of them are just ramblings from people. Some of them are interesting ramblings, and maybe from a voyeuristic perspective, you might get some entertainment value out of it. But some of them are really quite well done. I've listened to some that, are programs about different genres of music, and they'll have people playing music and talking about it, that kind of thing. There are a number of good technical podcasts where they talk about various computer issues, how to broadband forums, mm-hmm. and Mac forums, and various iterations of Windows and that kind of thing. So it's really kind of an extension of the idea of web blogging, but now it's audio. And the thought is, and already there's some of this happening, that the next thing is video. So
right, that was what I was going to ask you. Can it also do video files?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no reason. Again, it has to be, there's not a video format that is, I'd say, as near universal as MP3. But, there are a number of common formats, and I think eventually it'll end up being that way because, again, you can get a digital video camera now for, less than $500 in some cases. The device that used to cost a couple thousand just a few years ago. Just about any computer now can handle, the kind of home video stuff you're doing. You may not be able to make, professional movies on it, or it may be more difficult to make professional movies on it. But, you can do low-level hobbyist video, sometimes better than that, on just about any computer you've got now. And most computers come with some bare-bones software for doing it. So I think we'll see this kind of thing.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener. Caller on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. This might be too much of a question for radio, but I'm not very adept at computers at all, and I want to customize mine. It belonged to someone else, and so they set it up, but I would like to customize it. And the ones, classes I see advertised don't seem to address that. Maybe you could just head me in the direction of a...
All right. And ma'am, how would you like to, when you say you'd like to customize it, in what way?
I want to take off the things I don't need or want but I don't want to take off something that might be important, and I don't know the difference.
Uh-huh.
And I want to change some names on the files.
And is this a Windows machine?
Yeah,
is
it's
it running
an
Windows?
Machine.
Do you know what version of Windows it's running?
It's E-Machine. Millennium? Is that
ME? Yeah.
ME,
okay. Well, I'll tell you, one place you can go is, and I'll give you the web address, it's PrairieNet. It's a computing network here in town, and the web address is www.prairienet.org, okay?
Okay.
And they have some pretty basic classes for people. In fact, they're just about to start another round of those. And, you know, they teach you some of the things I think you're asking about. You know, they start with the idea that the first thing you need to do is learn how to plug the computer in, right? And they go from there. So I think they would show you some of these things that you'd like to know, and it'd give you a place, because the classes aren't big, where you can ask about some of those issues.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a couple of things in general.
Okay.
You know, almost all the programs you have installed in there will probably have some kind of an uninstall program. So if you go to the directory, the folder where that program is located, maybe on your start menu, and you scroll down, you'll see an uninstaller. And that can help you remove things that you don't use.
Okay.
Of course, as you said, your problem is that you don't know just what to remove and whatnot.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's best to err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
You know, and not remove anything that you don't know that you can safely remove.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, usually if you look at that, you can tell you probably don't want to start removing Windows components at this point. But usually software that's non-Windows, third-party software, is contained in your programs directory or folder, and you can kind of tell, you know, if it doesn't say Microsoft on it or it doesn't say Windows, you can kind of tell whether maybe it's a Windows program or not.
Okay.
And that gives you some idea about whether you might want to think about removing it or not.
All right.
A good thing to do is, if you see a program and you think you want to remove it, is to type it into Google. And type the name into Google and see what information you can find out about it.
Oh.
And if you find out it's not a Windows program, then, you know, maybe it's something you want to think about taking out there.
Okay.
Files that are created that, you know, some user has created, like word processing files or spreadsheets, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
There's usually not a big problem renaming those. And you can do that, in fact, by if you have a two-button mouse, right-clicking on the file. And you'll get a little menu, and one of the choices will be rename.
And, okay.
It'll let you do that. The codicil there is, again, if you're looking at, you know, Windows files and various pieces of programs, I'm not talking about things that you've created now, like spreadsheets and word processing documents and that kind of thing, but files that are, you know, part of the program. It's usually not a good idea to rename those, because both the operating system Windows and the program itself will look for those, you know, with a certain name.
Okay.
So if you change it, it's more than likely not going to be able to find it and use it.
Okay, thanks. I just thought of another question. When I turn on my computer, I have... what do they call it? Norton antivirus.
Uh huh.
When I turn it on, there's something that called Registry Editor that pops up,
uh-huh.
And I have no idea what it is. But it's just one more babysitting function that I have to perform to get
right.
my computer on, and it's annoying. Can I? Is there a way to get rid of that, or shut it up, or?
Well,
I did, or.
I'll say two things. I don't know why that would be. I'd need to see you know, I'd probably need to see your computer to see what was happening there to understand why it was coming up.
Oh, okay.
There's a setting where you can set certain things to start up with your computer so that every time you start it up, those things start up. And that may have been set to open when you start up your computer. Shouldn't have been, because the registry in Windows is kind of the big database, data storage place that keeps track of everything that's on your computer and all your settings and that kind of thing.
Oh.
And if you muck up the registry, remove something you shouldn't, put something in there that shouldn't be, you know, you can do everything up to rendering your computer inoperable. So what you really want to do if the registry editor is coming up when you start your computer is close it, you know, and
yes.
not do anything with it, because that can cause you problems.
Uh-huh.
And again, I think if you take one of these basic classes like PrairieNet has, they should tell you something about control panels, about the control panel and the various places where you can adjust settings there.
Might that be true of Urbana Adult Education?
Yes, yes.
Because it's much more convenient for me.
Right, right. I think either one of those would probably help you.
Okay.
There are some basic classes at Parkland Community College, too, and how to use Windows and various Windows programs.
Right.
But my experience with them, while they're excellent, has been that generally, you know, they don't start at the very beginning like
right.
you want. But they might be helpful to you. So you've got some options there.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Good luck.
Bye.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Lafayette, Indiana, on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I have had a problem this morning. I turned off my computer last night. Well, first I should tell you what's on it. I'm using Windows 2000, and I have a dial-up account. And I have zone alarm for my firewall. And I've been using AVG for virus control.
Uh-huh.
And before I turned off the computer last night, it said I needed an update on the AVG. I didn't have time to do it then, so I just turned the computer off. This morning, my daughter was using the computer. I don't know whether she went online or just used applications from the hard drive. But then when I went and turned it on and went to the hard drive, I went to the browser, I kept getting the appearance of the same page popping up over and over, not my home page. My home page came up first, but then all these repetitions of something from my eTrust kept popping up. And when I tried to download the update for AVG, it would never get completed because one of these my eTrust pages would pop up, but apparently that disconnected the function. Now, I'm wondering, is there any way I can run things from DOS to either do a virus check or to update the AVG?
Now, ma'am, my eTrust is what you're getting then.
That's where this page that keeps popping up on the browser is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I used to use that, but I haven't used it for 6 months.
You used to use that as your antivirus?
Yes,
software.
And then it had problems apparently with a zone alarm or something, mm-hmm. so I discontinued that and downloaded the AVG.
Yeah, did you delete it?
No, I didn't delete it.
Well, that's what that would be the first thing I would try.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's still on your computer, right?
Yes,
and
I thought maybe they would fix the problem between it and Zone Alarm, and I could start using it again.
Right. The problem is that it's generally not a good idea to have more than one antivirus program on your computer. You should select one and use it.
Yes,
because
I've been using just the one for. Since January.
Yeah.
And never had any problems.
Well, yeah, I don't know why it would have cropped up at this point. But the first thing, you know, may have been, it may have had something to do
yeah.
with
trying
to download definitions or something like that.
Control system, I could just uninstall.
Well, the first thing you want to do is check and see if eTrust has an uninstaller program of its own. Okay, so you look for a directory, a folder that has the eTrust software in it and see if there's an uninstaller in there.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to use the uninstaller for the individual program if there is one, because it's usually designed to remove all the you know, specifically designed to remove all the elements of that program, right?
All right.
Now, if that's not the case, you can go to the control panel and go to Windows Add, Remove Programs, and see if it's listed on there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then you could try using that to remove it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then I would also uninstall AVG, okay?
Okay.
And then, and then restart your computer, and then I would reinstall AVG to just kind of get a fresh start. So I really think you need to remove the old antivirus software. It's a bad idea to have more than one antivirus program on your computer because they frequently conflict with each other. And then I'd remove AVG2 and reinstall it to get kind of a fresh start.
Now, this page that keeps popping up from my eTrust said, thank you for purchasing their 205 version. Well, I haven't done that, and I don't know whether maybe I have a virus or a bug or something going on other than just a conflict.
Right. That's another possibility. I don't frankly know much about eTrust Easy. Mm-hmm. It's eTrust Easy Antivirus, right?
Right.
I'd have to look more into that. But you know, it's a possibility that in fact your browser has been hijacked and is taking you to a specific page.
Well, that's why I was asking. Is there a way of running a scan from DOS?
I don't think that would help you. No. I'd try the process that I outlined for you, and see if that solves the problem.
Okay.
That'd be the first thing I would do.
And if that doesn't, I'll call you back in a month.
Well, or you can send me an email, and I can look it up for my column. And my email is Kline, KLINE, at news-gazette.com.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
I appreciate your help.
Okay, I hope it helps.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana on line two.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I read that the architecture of the processor on the Macintosh had some kind of I don't know what it was, but something where it had like a dual processor where it has two things somewhere in there that could work at the same time, that could run at the same time.
Right.
I was wondering how that compares with the newer Intel.
Well, they're doing the same thing. In fact, pretty much everybody is. So, it's called having two cores. And I don't know that I don't remember that the G5 had that. But anyway, everybody is going to, you know, essentially more than one chip on a chip, right, or more than one brain on a chip type of design. So that's going to happen in either case. You know, and this is what I'll say. You know, we could get into an esoteric discussion about chip design and, you know, the AltaVec extensions that the PowerPC uses and MMX that the Pentium chips use, blah, 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 you know. And we could get into a discussion about, you know, 64-bit versus 32-bit and all this, okay? The bottom line is it doesn't matter to most people, okay, because the chips that are in your personal computer now, even a laptop, are powerful enough that unless you're, you know, really into the cutting-edge 3D games or doing what I would call professional quality video work or something of that nature, you're not gonna tax that chip. You're not gonna outrun its capacity. So, the question really is then, how much power does it consume if you're going to use it in a portable device so that you get good battery life? You know, does it have built-in wireless, which if it's a portable device, you pretty much want anymore? What's the cost of it, which affects the cost of the machine you buy, even if it's a desktop, not a laptop, that kind of thing. So I think that Intel probably trumps IBM on all of those kinds of consumer-oriented issues, and that's, you know, why they're doing this.
Can you do parallel programming with that architecture?
With Intel chips?
Yeah.
Well, they have boxes that are running more than one chip, so yeah, I suspect that you can. Again, who cares? I realize there are users who do care, and
I do numerical calculations.
It's important to you, but to eight, nine people out of ten,
not for surfing the internet or whatever.
Yeah, that just doesn't matter. So,
are those actually on the market? Multiprocessor machines.
I imagine if you went and Googled that, you could find multiprocessor Intel machines. Yeah. In the ultimate sense, over at the Advanced Computation Building that the NCSA has, where it has its supercomputing clusters, all they have is a bunch of Intel chips running in parallel. So, yeah. As one big supercomputer. So, certainly they're using it for that kind of stuff, and a lot of other people too.
I guess I was just wondering what the cost would be, whether you can just get one like for a couple thousand bucks or whatever with several processors.
I'm not sure about that. I imagine it would cost you some $1,000, but don't know.
Okay, so what about this dual core stuff? I guess maybe Macintosh was one of the first ones to do it, but then not everybody's pretty much using it now.
Well, I'm not sure that they do that yet in those PowerPC chips. What Apple has been doing for some time is putting two complete chips in its machines. It's not a dual core. It's not two brains on one chip. It's two complete chips. So it'd be like having, on the Windows side, it'd be like having a Pentium box with two Pentium 4s in it instead of one. So most of Apple's high-end machines now, the machines they intend for professional use, not the iMac, not obviously their laptops, because you can't do anything to dissipate the heat in those from two chips. But in their G5s, their big tower G5s, most of them have more than one chip in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not two brains on one chip. It's two brains on separate chips, essentially.
Okay,
and that's you can do that with Intel chips. You could do it with AMD chips. That's not that big a trick.
So are the cores pretty much just separate processors, or was there some kind of cooperation with them? Was it something other than? I mean, I know there's a difference between two processors on one chip versus one processor on each of two chips, but were the cores basically operating independently, even if they're on the same chip, or was there some sort of not really totally separate and like interacting or cooperating or something?
Yeah, and you're outstripping my knowledge of chip design, and probably the interest that most of the poor people out there have in this. But I'm sure that they work together. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, well, I'm sure if
it wouldn't do any good to have them sitting there working not together. I mean, that's the whole point. So
okay. So well, this sounds interesting. I just thought I'd ask about it.
Yeah, and unless you're in your case, where you're doing, it sounds like scientific.
I run stuff that takes like hours.
Yeah. It makes a difference to you, but to most people, it's just not going to make a difference.
Yeah,
because they're not going to outstrip the power of any of those chips anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's interesting. I think I'll look around for the multiprocessor machines.
All right.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I've got a couple questions about buying new Mac computers. I was thinking about buying maybe a Mac Mini this summer, but then with the announcement of the Macintosh machines, I've been debating whether or not it would be worthwhile to buy something now or just wait until the new machines come out and see how they work out price-wise, and was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, and again, I don't have a direct pipeline to Apple, okay?
Okay.
so I'm speculating here just like a lot of other people, maybe, reasonably educated speculating, but I suspect that – what were you going to buy the Mini for?
For home. For basically word processing, surfing the web, maybe very light editing of pictures.
Yeah.
I don't even have a digital camera right now, but that may be another purchase in the future.
Do you have a computer at home now?
I've got a collection of various low-end Macs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fastest machine I have right now is a G3 PowerBook with a 500 megahertz upgrade in it.
So this was going to be kind of a replacement upgrade. Type of thing, yeah. I'll say two things, some of which I kind of touched on before. I think if you went to the online or to a store or wherever right now and you bought a Mac Mini or you bought an iMac or you bought a iBook or a PowerBook, that you're going to get years of use out of that. It's going to be the hardware is going to be functional for a long time. You're going to have the software that's in there. The next generation of the operating system is going to work with it. For the foreseeable future, not for the foreseeable future, but for the next several years, let's say, software is going to be written to run on both those chips, Mac software to run both on PowerPC and IBM chips. So you're going to, I would say, you buy one now, you're going to get your use out of it. Okay. Depending on how long, of course, you were thinking about keeping it.
Well, I've tended to hang on to computers for a while.
Yeah. And
I do have one other question, though, and this is maybe more personal preference, but kind of the debate between laptop versus desktop. And my main computer right now is an old laptop.
Uh-huh.
But I really would like to have I'm not sure if I want to replace it with a laptop or go with the Mac Mini. I know that the Mac Mini would be a lot cheaper than buying even a used laptop.
Right.
And I prefer getting something that would have the more modern, the most recent software on it.
Well, what I tell people with this question is always, look, do you want it to be portable? Okay. Do you have some need for portability? Even if we're just talking about maybe you want to, go sit in your Lazy Boy and surf the internet wirelessly or whatever, that's a need for portability. But maybe you really want to haul it around, on vacation or to work or whatever. If you have a need for portability, then fine, get a laptop. Okay.
Okay.
But if that machine's just going to sit on a desk and it's not going to move or rarely move, if ever, buy a desktop, because you always get more for less money in buying a desktop, because there's a premium price, in the miniaturized components that go in a laptop. So if you're not going to move it, get a laptop.
Okay.
If you're not going to move it, get a desktop. Sorry. If you have some need for mobility, even if it's just moving around your house, then get a laptop.
All right.
The other thing I'll say is about the Intel chips going into Apple. I do not think it may lower the price of Apple machines a little, but I do not think it's going to lower them very much. In fact, I don't think Apple will let it lower them very much, because that cuts into their bottom line.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Savoy on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello. I was going to ask one or two kinds of questions, but then as I'm bringing up my computer, something that used to never happen was again happening, and it seems to be coming more often. I can say that as it went up and flashed up the Windows screen with that logo of theirs and everything, that was perfect, and then it began to install things on the desktop and on the taskbar, and that seemed to be fine. And then while I'm getting ready to call you, this phenomenon starts. It's like it was a TV screen and multiple kinds of flippings and flashings and divided up lines, and it's almost as if it were trying to bring up windows or pages that I had. It's had the division right down the middle of the screen like I frequently have, so I can have two things running at once and looking at them at once. And whenever it happens, it seems to happen longer and more intensely, and you can't use the thing while it's happening. The picture is just, so chopped up into little teeny lines that there's nothing there, but it's almost reminiscent of some of the pages that would be there by my own design, except that they weren't even on the taskbar because it was starting up fresh. And have you ever heard of anything like this? I don't know what's happening.
No. So you start your computer, and things start to load up.
This is how it happened this time. Most mm-hmm. of the time when it's happened, everything's been going fine, and I may be using it for a half hour or more, and then all of a sudden this thing starts to happen. And then it's tended to quit on its own, but now it stays with me, as it were, much longer than it used to.
So it's you are describing it as it's flashing things on the screen that used to be there?
It's almost like it was trying uh-huh. to bring up things that I have put there before, but you know, I can see colors and little lines of design that are very reminiscent of some of the websites that I use frequently.
When did this start?
Well, sometime in the last 6 months. But it, you know, it may go days or weeks without happening.
Mm-hmm. And
but just this very time when it did it, it was much more intense. I mean, you couldn't even find the place to hit okay to do the shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
It was so thoroughly clabbering up the entire screen.
So it's not even it doesn't even it's not even making any sense. It's just like a jumble of stuff.
Yeah,
on the
closest thing I could describe it to is like the old TV sets when snow or uh-huh. flippings would occur. Except, you know, this is huge numbers of little lines, and it's like they're jumping back and forth across the up and down portion of the screen while they are also trying to flip around like the old TV screens would do.
Well, I would first I'd like you to send me an email with a description of this, okay? So I can look further into it, and then I'm gonna posit a couple of things, okay?
I dictate your email.
It's Klein, KLINE, @ news-gazette.com. Okay?
GAZETTE.com. All right, thank you.
Now, monitors can sometimes suffer from, for want of a better term, I'll call it electromagnetic interference, okay, for one reason or another. And you probably have a button or a software setting on your monitor that says something like degauss, okay?
Uh-huh.
And you might want to run that process because...
How do you find that?
Well, you have buttons on your monitor, right? I don't know what...
I'm working on the laptop.
Oh, okay. Well, no, so you shouldn't have that problem then. Yeah. If it's a laptop, that shouldn't be the problem. So you're working on a laptop then.
Yeah.
You know, you may be losing some connections to the screen inside your laptop.
Oh.
You know, some of those may have worn or you know, cracked or broken or whatever. Little wires, right? They may not be completely gone. So it might be dependent on, you know, what position your screen is in, that kind of thing, that causes that to come into play. And so you see that kind of glitchy stuff happen there. So I might have that checked out if I were you.
How?
Well, you'd need to take it to you know, someone who works on laptops.
Oh. Okay.
So that sounds like, you know, I'd like you to send me the email so I can look further into it. There may be some other reason, but now that, you know, having told me that we're talking about a laptop here, and the way you describe the problem, this is the kind of thing I've seen happen with people's laptops before when they were losing some kind of connection between, you know, the board of the laptop and the screen.
Oh.
So.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Hope that helps. Greg, thanks so much for joining us again.
That went quickly.
It did. Time's up. Well, we'll talk again in August?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, very good. Greg Klein is science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, and this program about computers is a program we do once a month on the third Thursday of the month. Greg will be back with us in August, next month in July on the third Thursday. Peter Kimball will be with us. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was very much a mixed day across the Chicago Board of Trade today. We saw a lot of weather watching as well as a breather after what has been a fairly big run-up this week, especially in that soybean pit. One programming note before we get to the settlements, please remember that USDA Secretary Mike Johanns will be the featured guest live this afternoon with closing market host Todd Gleason. Of course, that show getting underway at 2:06. Let's go ahead and then go and check the prices for you. And as we always do, let's go ahead and begin in the wheat pit. July, a high on the day of 328.5, a low of 322, settling 323.5 up a half. September, a high of 338.25, a low of 332, settling 333.25 up a quarter. December, a high of 350, a low of 343, settling 343.5, down 1.25. March, a high of 360, a low of 354, settling 354 on the low, down 1.5 on the day. The May contract, a high of 362, a low of 357, settling on the low, down 2.5 on the day. July corn, a high of 227.5, a low of 223, settling 225.75, up 1.5. September, a high of 236.25, a low of 232.25, settling 234.75, up 1. December, a high of 247, a low of 243, settling 245.5, up 1. March, a high of 254.25, a low of 251, settling 253.25, up 1. May, a high of 257, a low of 254, settling 256.25, up 3 quarters. And the Redline July corn contract, a high of 260.25, a low of 258, settling 260, up 3 quarters on the day. July oats, a high of 155, a low of 149, settling 150.25, down 5. September, a high of 160.5, a low of 153.25, settling 154.5, down 5.25. July soybeans, a high of 707, a low of 698.5, settling $7.75, down 1.75. August, a high of 711, a low of 702.5, settling 706.25, down 0.25. September, a high of 715, a low of 707, settling 710.5, up 1.5. November, a high of 726, before coming back down to the ground, 716.25 to the low, settling 720.5, down 0.25 on the day. January, a high of 726, a low of 718, settling 720, down 0.25. And March, a high of 713.5, a low of 706, settling 710.25, up 3.75 on the day. July soybean meal, a high of 225.50, a low of 221.20, settling 223, down 90. August, a high of 226.20, a low of 221.50, settling 222.90, down 160. July soybean oil, a high of 24.53, a low of 23.96, settling 24.10, down 7. The August contract, a high of 24.63, a low of 24.05, settling 24.18, down 14 on the day. The settlement price is also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where Celeste, a mixed day, up in the hogs and down in the cattle.
That's right. Let's start out with cattle, feeder cattle, August feeder cattle. That contract high today, 109.50, the low 107.75, the settlement 107.85, that down 90. September, 108.35, the high, the low 106.60, the settlement 106.67.5, down 115. October 106.75, the high 105.40, the low 105.62.5, the settlement, that down 57.5. June live cattle 82.25, the high 81.15, the low, the settlement 81.20, that down 70. August 80.77.5, the high, the low 79.40, the settlement 79.42.5, down 77.5. July lean hogs 68.10, the high 66.92.5, the low, the settlement 67.95, that up 12.5. August 67 even, the high 65.50, the low, the settlement 66.67.5, that up 27.5. October 57.85, the high, the low 56.60, the settlement 57.55, that up 25. December lean hogs 55.05, the high, the low 53.80, the settlement 54.92.5, that finishing up 90 cents. July pork bellies 66.80, the high 63.25, the low, the settlement 65.77.5, that up 7.5. The Dow's up 7 points at 10,573. The NASDAQ 9 higher at 2084. The S&P 500 up 3 at 1210.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Stephen McCullough from Ballycarl, North Ireland writes, "Dear Dr. Science, do teachers secretly want you to fail?"
It's no secret. Teachers are the angriest people around. As survivors of academic emotional abuse, they seek to spread the pain. This natural desire for healing is in itself pathological, but our desire to have our children safely warehoused while we're at work mitigates any effort to stop this deadly cycle of abuse. What are most teachers other than poorly paid prison guards? Some effective false persona that suggests a refined and gentle spirit, but underneath the mask, they're both prison guard and con, like Genghis Khan.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary live show on DVD, go to drscience.com.
The people who pick tomatoes for Taco Bell are celebrating.
Yeah!
They led a seemingly hopeless 4-year boycott against the fast food chain. Now, the pickers are getting a raise.
Challenging the largest fast food industry on the planet and succeeding on that, yeah, sometimes is unbelievable.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director today, the producer for the Afternoon Magazine.